Well, it's no secret that we are living in unprecedented times. We're experiencing a pandemic that is unique. As I mentioned before, it can be infectious without symptoms. And the fact is, this whole issue is going to have long-lasting social effects and long-lasting economic effects that are not yet totally apparent. You know, and then we have these terrible fires in the West. As I said, the rate of growth is unprecedented. I talked to one of the fire bosses about the fire that was near our area, about 10 miles north of us, and he said normal firefighting rules just don't apply. It's too hot. It's moving too fast, and what our techniques we're having to invent on the spot, because the old ones are not working. Several towns have been completely destroyed, and if you watch or listen to the news, several victims have described it as Armageddon. And if you're familiar with Dante's Inferno and those woodcuts that are part of that book, the videos we have of California and Oregon remind you of that. Many people have lost everything they had, and of course, a number have lost their lives. We have ongoing riots and unrest in our cities, and yes, there are peaceful protesters, and yes, they have legitimate concerns, but there are others who are there to loot and destroy. And obviously, there is something more behind all of this, and time will tell. What the motives are behind this, I think some of it's obvious. And then we have our national debt. People don't talk about that because that's inconvenient. The U.S. debt now is over $22 trillion. We're going to add $3 trillion just this year. And that means that each one of us, man, woman, child, newborn baby in the United States, owes almost $1 million each as part of we're part of that. And then there's increasing polarization in our government and in our society. That is not new. The prime motivation of our executive branch and of the legislative branch is to get reelected. Not to serve the people who elected them, but to keep the power and the perks which they have, and that comes first. Just gross selfishness. Our colleges and universities are largely controlled by those who despise and demonize religion, who do not even acknowledge the existence of the Almighty, and who despise and demonize our country. That has been going on for decades, but it's coming to critical mass. And for decades, the universities have been turning out students who want to remake society into a secular, godless, anything-goes nation. And as I said, it's hitting critical mass. It's coming to pass right before our eyes. And the fact is today that you can see it on the media that few people really listen to what the other person is having to say. Few people are willing to talk reasonably. Rather, you see a lot of irrational screaming and screaming a godless ideology back and forth. And as I said, selfishness is abounding. And so we indeed live in unprecedented times, and I've had many inquiries over the phone and emails saying, well, is this the beginning of the end? Are we starting the tribulation? Where are we? So I thought it might be good to look at that subject today, especially on this Day of Trumpets. And James very graphically told us out of God's Word what we can expect. But, and you know, this Day of Trumpets looks forward to the Almighty's wrath and establishing His direct rule over mankind to a world that increasingly does not even know Him. And so I thought it might be profitable to answer the question, where are we in these end times? where are we prophetically in the end times? So what we're going to do, we're going to do three things today. We'll look at pertinent scriptures, and then we are going to draw conclusions from those scriptures. And then lastly, we will look at what we need to be doing in light of those scriptures. Okay, so point one, let's look at some pertinent scriptures. You want to turn to Matthew 24. Of course, you knew we were going there, but please place a marker there because we're going to bounce around to other scriptures and then come back to Matthew 24. We'll begin in verse 3, and all of this will be out of the King James unless otherwise noted. Matthew 24 and verse 3. We're told, as he, referring to Jesus Christ, sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, to the disciples, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world? The Greek word for world is aion, which we get our English word eon, and it just means an age. When is going to be the end of this age? And in verse 4, Jesus answered and said unto them, to the disciples, take heed, first thing he said, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name. And just look around today. Look at the number of churches that have the name Christ in their name. Many will come in my name, saying, I am Christ, acknowledging Christ is who he is, and yet, Christ says, they will deceive many. There will be those who acknowledge Christ as the Messiah, but in the process of acknowledging Christ, they will deceive many. Have to be prepared for that. We know that. How's that going to occur? It's through Satan-induced blindness, because he's blinded the whole world. We know that. So Satan induces blindness in the hearts of those that proclaim to be religious in order to lead them astray. They misrepresent who Christ is, in many cases weak, effeminate. They emphasize his love to the exclusion of all else. They ignore Luke 19 and verse 27. Let's turn there, keeping your marker in Matthew 24. But turn back to Luke 19 and verse 27, because Christ is speaking something profound that tells you about him and his nature and what he is like. Luke 19 and verse 27. Notice what he says. This is not often read, especially for those who emphasize the love of Christ. But those my enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring them here and slay them before me. Christ says, I want to watch their destruction. I want to watch their death. So people can misrepresent who Christ actually is, and then there are others who promote him above his Father, a so-called Christ-centered religion, and that has crept into the churches of God over time. And again, they ignore John 5 and verse 30. Let's turn there. Those who would promote Christ above his Father, and it is done subtly these days, and not saying it outright, but just not mentioning the Father all that much and focusing almost exclusively on Jesus Christ, they ignore John 5 and verse 30. I'll read this out of the NLT. Christ says, but I do nothing without consulting the Father. I judge as I am told by the Father, obviously, and my judgment is absolutely just, but is because it is according to the will of God who sent me. It is not merely my own. The one who sends is superior to the one who has sent. The one who tells is superior to the one who is told. And many are going to be deceived as a result of this, not knowing who Christ is, not knowing his relationship with his Father, and therefore not knowing who the Father is. People are deceived. Let's go back now to Matthew 24. We'll pick it up in verse 6. Matthew 24 and verse 6. Christ says, "And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars." Says that's going to happen, but notice what he says. "See that you be not troubled." Don't be troubled by this. Don't be worried or afraid by this. "For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Then verse 7 begins four signs that Christ gives that the end is approaching. Verse 7, he says, "For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom." Now, this has been going on since before the Noachian flood. We understand that. But since we are in the end times, let's take a look at the last 100 years, going back to World War I, and let's look at the number of deaths from war, including World War I, since up until today. And keep in mind that when you list the deaths, typically in a war, the number of wounded are five times greater than the number of deaths. But we're just going to talk about deaths. And understand these are estimates. Only God knows the truth, the actual facts. But this is what is estimated from our viewpoint today. World War I, which started in 1914, ended in 1918, estimated 50 million people died. Mostly military, because World War I was fought in the trenches and didn't spread to cities and towns and hamlets. After that, of course, we have Stalin's purges, and he systematically starved whole areas of his country to death. That started in 1924, ended in 1953 with his death. But there are somewhere between 8 and 40 million died in his purges. Then we come to World War II, started in 1939, ended in 1945. And including the 6 million Jews of the Holocaust, there were somewhere between 55 and 85 million deaths in World War II. And then after that, Mao Zedong came to power in China, and he began to purge his own country. From 58 until 62, he killed 45 million of his own countrymen to establish his power. He waged war on his own countrymen. Then the war in Korea came along, 1950 to 1953. I remember that as a young kid. 1.5 to 4.5 million died. We'll never know how many died on the Chinese and North Korean side, but 1.5 to 4.5 million. Then Vietnam, 1961 to 1975, somewhere between 2.5 million and 4.5 million died during the Vietnam era. Then a little known civil war, the Nigerian Civil War from 1967 to 1970, killed 1.3 million Nigerians. Think of that. Then I can remember this too, India versus Bangladesh. Just in 1 year, 1971, 3 million people died in that war between India and Bangladesh in 1971. Then we have the Iraq-Iran War, 1980 to 1988. Over 1 million died there, slaughtering each other. Then, again, a not well-known war, the Second Sudanese War, began in 1983 and lasted till 2005 and killed somewhere between 1 and 2 million Sudanese. And then you have the First and Second Congo Wars, started in 96, ended in 2000. Somewhere between 2.75 and 5.5 million were killed in the Congo in their wars. And then, of course, familiar to all of us is the war in Afghanistan. It began with the Soviets in 1978. It continues to this day. And somewhere between 1.25 million and 2 million have died in Afghanistan as a result of that war. Now, I've left off all the wars with less than 1 million deaths, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens, like the current Syrian civil war, where Assad is killing his own people. Somewhere between 400,000 and 600,000 Syrians have been killed, murdered in that civil war. And of course, then we come to the Cold War. That started in 1947, ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But as we know, that was the first time in the history of mankind that man had the ability to destroy all humanity from the face of the earth. And I was in the military when that started, or not when it started, but as it was ongoing. And that's why Matthew and Mark both state that except the Lord had shortened these days, there would be no flesh left alive. And the fact is, and I'm going to give you two examples here just to show you how close we came to annihilating mankind. The first is the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think everybody knows how close we came. That was 13 days in October in 1962. But what most people don't know is when the U.S. sent a task force down to blockade Cuba, there was a Russian submarine nearby that was tracking the U.S. task force, which included an aircraft carrier, and that submarine had nuclear-tipped torpedoes. There were three Russian generals on that submarine, and their rules of engagement were that if they were going to attack the task force and take out that submarine, all three generals had to agree. And as the task force came into Cuban waters, that submarine was prepared to attack. Those three generals had a meeting in that submarine, and two were vehemently wanting to take out the aircraft carrier. And thankfully, one Russian general said, no, we just can't do that. It will lead to a Holocaust, a worldwide conflagration. So they held to their rules. The sub went to deep waters and then sailed out of the area, and we came really, really close. And there were other close calls, too, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But a second example, not as well known, occurred on November 9th, 1979. I think you've heard of the name NORAD, North American Air Defense Command. It's headquartered in this giant granite mountain, Cheyenne Mountain, west of Denver. And it was built there because it could handle a direct hit from a nuclear weapon. And on November 9th, 1979, the NORAD early warning system showed that the Soviet Union had launched 250 ballistic missiles toward the United States. The NORAD commander on duty there notified, they have a hotline to Washington, the president's desk. They notified Jimmy Carter that this was happening and that he needed, if he was going to retaliate it at all, a decision needed to be made between 3 and 7 minutes from that phone call, because the NORAD showed them they had already been launched. And Jimmy Carter declared DEFCON 2. DEFCON stands for Defense Condition 2. Defense Condition 1 is all-out war. That means the missiles are launched from the submarines and the missiles in the United States. So they came right up to DEFCON 1, declaring DEFCON 2. That means all the SAC B-52s were scrambled. The underground ICBMs and the submarines, ballistic missile subs, were prepared to launch, just waiting for DEFCON 1. Then what happened after that was that the NORAD computers placed the number of incoming missiles at 2,200. That means it was an all-out attack. And this was, now we were within like 3 minutes of President Carter pressing the button. And about 1 to 2 minutes before decision time, satellite and radar images showed that this attack was a false alarm. And we came that close. And a later investigation found that a training scenario was loaded into an operational computer by accident. And what they assumed was real was actually a training scenario that they would normally use as a drill. I assume some heads rolled on that account. But the fact is, twice we have come very close to total annihilation. And when you think about it, wars and rumors of wars take on an entirely new meaning when we see how close we have come. Today, the world nuclear stockpile is held by 9 countries. And there are a total of 13,355 nuclear warheads held by 9 countries. The U.S. and Russia account for 92% of those warheads. The largest of those warheads is Russian. And you remember the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima? This Russian nuclear warhead is 3,800 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. During a test, when they tested that bomb, it broke windows 550 miles away. You can imagine how powerful and how destructive that weapon is. So currently, wars and rumors of wars. We have Russia in Ukraine. Russia is trying to annex Ukraine, certainly the eastern part of it, in Crimea. We have the U.S. in Russia. We have the Arabs in Israel. We have the U.S. in Iran. Iran scrambling to get nuclear weapons to put on missiles. We have China and Taiwan, which is a hot spot. And then we have the U.S. in China. And then, of course, talking about wars, and this is what aggravates me just about more than anything, is the unspoken war on unborn babies. We have a worldwide war on unborn babies. The average right now is 56 million deaths per year. That means in 1 year, we kill more babies than all the deaths in World War II. But we do it in 1 year. Of course, everybody sweeps that under the rug, saying, well, that's women's choice. Well, have we already experienced wars and rumors of wars as of this date? Well, increasingly so. You bet we have. Now let's go back to verse 7, continuing on with the second sign. It tells us there shall be famines. A UN report in September of 2018 brought forth new evidence to indicate that the number of hungry people in the world is growing. And in 2018, the estimate was that 821 million suffered famine the year before in 2017. Today, it is estimated 1 out of every 9 humans on this earth wakes up hungry and goes to bed hungry. 1 out of every 9. Famines? You bet. Going on in verse 7, third sign, pestilences. Plague or disease, the Greek means. So, some background on pestilences. Let's begin to look at the most fatal pandemic in human history. It was spread by fleas from infected rats, and that is the Black Plague of the mid-1300s. Just an aside here, Shiloh, could you update the clock for me? Need to know where I am here. Okay. So the Black Plague began in the 1300s, and it was the most fatal one in human history. It was spread by fleas from infected rats. And new research into that through DNA and other ways shows that it began in the spring of 1346 in the steppe region northwest of the on the shores of the Caspian Sea, and then spread into southern Russia. And it took 7 years to spread throughout Europe because there was no mass transit back then. People were on foot or horseback or donkey. It took 7 years to spread throughout Europe. And the deaths are estimated between 50 and 200 million from the Black Plague. It killed approximately 60% of Europe's population, 30% of the world's population. And the fact is, there were over 30 waves of the plague after the first wave. The last outbreak, it's been documented, occurred in 1654. That's over 300 years after the start. You know, that's kind of a scary thought for us today. And the only reason I bring this long ago plague up is to show you what has already happened and what can and is prophesied to happen again. And we just have a hint today by the coronavirus. That's just a little hint. So with that in mind, let's go to the 1919 flu, I think called the Spanish flu by many. It killed more people than World War I did. It's estimated that somewhere between 50 and 100 million were killed. That was 20% of the world's population in 1919. And what most people don't know is it began in Oklahoma in the United States. A bunch of farmers got together and they were burning manure, great piles of manure that accumulated. The fire got out of control. These huge plumes of smoke were drifting now east into the neighboring states. And it wasn't long after that that people began to show flu-like symptoms downwind of that burn. Then people began to be infected by this flu, but the United States at that time was calling up troops to go to Europe, to France, to fight World War I. The U.S. troops took it into France. It spread to the English and the French and the Germans. And then it circulated around because you remember they were in trenches, very close quarters, no such thing as social distancing and wearing masks back then. And it circulated among the troops. And then the U.S. brought it, the U.S. soldiers returning from World War I brought it back. That flu killed 45,000 U.S. soldiers. And that's almost as many as died in combat. 53,400 died in combat, real close. So today we have the 2020 coronavirus. And there's some evidence to suggest that it began in a biological weapons plant in Wuhan, China, or at a minimum due to some unsanitary conditions at a wild animal market. No one knows for sure. Someday we'll find out. But the fact is it spread around the world, not in a matter of years or months, but in a matter of weeks, primarily due to widespread air travel, people running to and fro. And as you know, the worldwide deaths are pegged at around 900,000. The U.S. deaths are approaching 200,000. And I do understand the problems with statistics. In our area, in Yakima County, the number of deaths is underreported because there are a great many illegals who have come down with COVID. They will not go to a hospital because they and their families don't want to be deported. So they die in silence, so to speak. But I also know that in other areas, it is overreported. And as with any flu virus, it will mutate and continues to mutate. And as I mentioned earlier about the bubonic plague, it could mutate and come back year after year, just as the common flu does. We don't know. But the fact is, it's devastated the world economy, and we have yet to feel the full effects of that devastation. And it probably will have a greater impact on humanity than the disease itself, meaning the economic cost of this. Okay, back to Matthew now, verse 7, the fourth sign, earthquakes in various places. Well, this hasn't happened yet. The proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2012 examined the frequency of large magnitude earthquakes from 1900 to 2011, and they discovered that the frequency of earthquakes 8.0 and greater is slightly elevated since 2004 at a rate of about 1.2 to 1.4 a year, but that is not statistically significant. So it's clear that earthquakes have yet to dramatically increase, but the fact is it could happen overnight. Dorothy and I are perfect witnesses to that fact because we were 70 miles directly downwind from Mount St. Helens when that mountain blew, and we didn't know it was going to blow. But within a couple hours, certainly a half a day, our world changed radically. Radically. That's a story in and of itself, but changed radically in about a half a day. Now let's go to verse 8. Christ says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. And the Greek word for sorrows, if you look at Help's word studies, it's the Greek word odin, O-D-I-N. And it means the pain of childbirth. Figuratively, the pain necessary to open up or introduce something new. So the beginning of sorrows is going to open up something new for the rest of the world. And I think we know what that is. So the question is, are we in the beginning of sorrows? Looks like we've been there for quite some time to me. The last 100 years are just 1.7% of recorded history. And are these the last days? Well, I reckon so. Now let's go to verse 9, because Christ comes to the church. He says, then, after the beginning of sorrows, he says, then shall they deliver you, he's referring, talking to the disciples in verse 3, deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Good time to ask a question. Well, what is Christ's name? Remember, in we won't turn there, Matthew 16 and verse 16, Christ said to the disciples, who do people say I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of the living God. Well, this obviously happened to the New Testament church, the early New Testament church, and happened in the Middle Ages, but it is yet to happen in our time. But that is coming. I saw a recent sermon. Somebody sent me a recent sermon by a prominent Protestant evangelist, one of these heads of one of these mega churches. And he was giving a sermon, and he asked, what is the definition of a Christian? What is the litmus test of being a Christian? I thought, well, this is going to be interesting to see what the man says. And you know what he said? He said the litmus test of being a Christian is a belief in the Trinity. Of all things he could have said, this one came out of left field, but you can understand, given their training, their education, and all of that, it is the belief in the Trinity. Well, could this be where the line is drawn in the future as far as a beast power or a false prophet persecuting non-Christians? Well, a non-Christian could be somebody who does not believe in the Trinity, be it Muslim or anybody else. Verse 10, then shall many be offended to the point that they shall betray one another and they shall hate one another. Now, we often think of being offended as somebody getting their feelings hurt, somebody possibly becoming angry or walking away in a snit. That's what we think of today as being offended. But the Greek word for offended is Strong's 4624, and it is the Greek word scandalizo, where we get our English word to scandalize. And it has a different meaning than we think with the word offended. It means to entrap, to trip up, to stumble, to entice to sin, or entice to apostasy, entice to turn away from true doctrine, true teaching. And this tells us that many are going to be tripped up, enticed to sin, or believe in false doctrine. And that's been ongoing, as we know, since the first century. But it began creeping into the modern-day Church of God in the 1950s. And today, apostasy in or out of the church is much more widespread. And we're being told here it will ultimately lead to betrayal, to hate, as a result, as some have already experienced in our time. Going on in verse 11, we're told, and many, not a few, many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many. The Greek word translated for false prophet just means a religious imposter. Religious imposters have always existed because Satan never rests. But it will get worse to the end that we will have the false prophet in Revelation 16. So we're getting a taste. There's a bunch of false prophets running around, but there will be a coalition resulting in the false prophet. In verse 12, and because iniquity, Greek means violation of the law or wickedness, because wickedness shall abound, the violation of the law shall abound, the love of many will wax cold. That is the result of not following God's law. Now, Mark 13 and verse 12 adds to this narrative. So let's turn there and keep your marker in Matthew 24, Mark 13 and verse 12. Mark 13 and verse 12 says, because iniquity abounds, now the brother shall betray the brother to death. This is serious stuff. And this is what gets me. And the father, the son, to death. And the children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. Now that's happened before. Sometimes in the Middle Ages it wasn't all that common, but it has happened before. But this is going to be something new and something serious. John 16 also Christ warns. John 16 verse 2, let's turn there. Christ warns the disciples on the last night he was alive, spending time with them. John 16 and verse 2. Christ warns, he says, you will be expelled from the synagogues. And of course, moving that forward to today, you will be expelled from the church, churches, organization, whatever it is. And the time is coming down that road when those who kill you will think they are doing God a service. This happened during the Inquisition in the Middle Ages. It's happened down through the centuries. It will happen again as we get closer to the end. It's just a fact. In fact, some today would already have been burned at the stake if we lived in the Middle Ages. Some today for some of the things that are being preached. Now let's go back to Matthew 24, verse 13. Now despite all of this, Christ says to us, he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. It's an endurance race. James Smith keeps reminding me because I tend to not be that way. By nature, James reminds me that we're in a marathon, not a sprint. And he says, Rick, you're in a sprint. Slow down a little bit. And I take the admonition, and we all need to keep it in mind. I think sometimes we sprint as fast as we can. We fall to our feet in exhaustion. We take a couple of breaths and get up and start sprinting again, you know. Verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached. Greek word is published or proclaimed. In addition to being preached, it will be preached in all the world for a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Now that was done to a small extent by the Worldwide Church of God. It reached a peak 35 years ago. Hard to believe, 35 years ago. But this current generation has not received that warning, either in the Western countries or in the world. It will happen in the future, and Mark Mickelson mentioned that in a recent sermon talking about the two witnesses doing so in Revelation 11. But there is going to be, in addition to that, there will be an additional way that it will happen. Let's go to Revelation 14 and verse 6 and see that there's going to be a miraculous way and see that God is going to have the gospel preached regardless of what human beings do or do not do. Revelation 14 and verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven. Notice this, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth. Notice this, to every nation and every kindred and every tongue and every people. This is an angel saying with a loud voice. Now, what is the gospel? the everlasting gospel that this angel is going to preach. Fear God and give glory to Him. What a concept. Fear God and give glory to Him. For the hour of His judgment is come. Worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains and the waters. Notice the focus of the warning. It's on the Father to fear Him, glorify Him, and worship Him. First commandment. Think about that. That's the focus of the warning. And the point is, the gospel is going to be proclaimed. Two witnesses, this angel. But at present, during this age, and frankly since the demise of worldwide, it's apparent that right now the Father does not want it done. Because there are clones, several clones worldwide that are trying to do that and reinvent worldwide to do work to preach the gospel, and there have been no results from that. No appreciable results at all. But the point is, the Father will have the gospel preached when and how He chooses, and He can raise up stones to do it any time He wants to. Need to keep that in mind. So let's go back now to Matthew 24 and verse 15. I'll read this out of the NIV. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. The Greek word for abomination means a detestation. It would be something we detest. We just can't stand. It says a detestation that is especially idolatry. There is an abomination, idolatry, that causes desolation. Idolatry, as we know, is a common thread since Adam and Eve. And we're going to see that this causes a desolation, and we will see how this plays out. We'll need to keep our eyes open. And then in Matthew 24, verses 16 to 30, tell very clearly that if you're in Judea, you better get out. And Luke 21 adds, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you better get out. And now to verse 21 of Matthew 24. For then, after all of this happens, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be. The Greek word for tribulation is Strong's 2247, and it means pressure, literally or figuratively. It means affliction, anguish, burdened, persecution, or trouble. And it's interesting, the Hebrew word is almost exactly the same. Now, the words great tribulation are only mentioned three times in the Bible, once here and twice in Revelation. And the word for great here is the Greek word megas, M-E-G-A-S, which we get our English word mega. And notice this, it means literally or figuratively big plus exceeding fear. So it's a word that has two meanings. It's large, but it includes a concept of exceeding fear. It means mighty plus to be sore afraid. So we see here that this word great has a component of fear mixed into the definition. So we see that pressure, persecution, trouble coupled with fear is coming our way. Not a pretty scene, but we know it has to come. And of course, we don't want to be caught up in fear. And we'll talk about that as we go on. Now, verse 22. Except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh be saved. We're in those days because mankind can destroy himself off the face of the earth. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say to you, now he's speaking about the church in the future, lo, here is Christ, or there, don't believe it. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets. Now here's the key, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive, meaning these signs and wonders, shall deceive or trip up the very elect. And the fact is, we need to heed this warning and prepare ourselves for a time when a religious entity is coming on the scene, and there will be unbelievable miracles and signs and wonders that if you just look at those, the common man is going to say, ah, this is from God. This is the man. We should fall down and worship this man or this system. And so we're being warned in advance of that event. Verse 25, behold, I have told you before, where if they say unto you, behold, he's in the desert, don't go there. Behold, he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it. Verse 27, I'll read out of the NLT. It gets it right. For as the lightning lights up the entire sky, so it will be when the Son of Man comes. Christ is saying, when I come, it's not going to be in secret. It's going to be wide open. The whole world is going to know. And then notice going on in verse 28 out of the NLT, just as the gathering of vultures shows there is a carcass nearby, so these signs indicate that the end is near. Let's jump to verse 35. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away, because we're reading them right now. But of that day and hour knows no one. No, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only. Christ is saying, I don't know. I'm waiting for my Father to tell me. So, you know, how many times have we said, this is such clear evidence that there are two beings, they are separate beings, and one knows something the other doesn't. And the one who knows something that the other doesn't, the one who knows it, is supreme. And at some point in time, the Father will turn to the Son and say, it's time. Let's go. And then all of this will happen. So we've looked at some of the scriptures. The first part of the sermon, we've looked at some of the scriptures. Now let's see what conclusions we can draw from what we've read. And obviously there are dozens and dozens of conclusions, but we're just going to hit four of them. The first one is it's obvious we have been in the beginning of sorrows for quite some time. When we look at the last 100 years, we've had two world wars that have killed over 120 million people, and then five times that have been maimed, injured. And then we have had untold millions of babies murdered in the last 100 years. It's been institutionalized by governments. We've had two pandemics, the one we have now and the 1919 flu. And then we have real famine going on today. So we have seen that we are in the beginning, you know, we're in the beginning of sorrows and have been there for 100 years. Point two is we see that the conditions are set for the time of the end. Conditions are set for the time of the end. Let's go to Daniel 12 and verse 1. Daniel 12 and verse 1. Talking about our day, Daniel 12, verse 1. Daniel says, Daniel 12, verse 1, King James, at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble. Same definition in the Hebrew as the Greek, adversity, affliction, anguish, distress. Such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And at that time, notice this, your people shall be delivered. That is a promise. Everyone that shall be found written in the book. Verse 4, but you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. And notice what he says. What are the couple of characteristics of the time of the end? Many shall run to and fro, number one. And number two, knowledge shall be increased. And today we have a graphic example of how much running to and fro can spread a pandemic. People are running to and fro, and look what we have. But it also says knowledge shall be increased. Let's look at the accumulation of knowledge and see if that's not the case here in these days. In 1982, there was a futurist and inventor, you might have heard his name, Buckminster Fuller. And he was asked, if you take all the knowledge since man's recorded history up until 1 AD, all that knowledge over thousands of years, and put it together, how long did it take that knowledge up to 1 AD to double? And Fuller began to analyze that, and his estimate was it took for that accumulated knowledge prior to 1 AD to double, it took until 1500 AD, 1500 years to double, several thousand years to accumulate in the beginning, 1500 years to double. And it was followed by another doubling in only 250 years. That brings us to about 1750. And by 1900, another 150 years later, Fuller estimated that the amount of knowledge had doubled again in only 150 years. Then at the beginning of the 21st century, roughly 20 years ago, it was estimated, and I remember that, it was estimated knowledge is doubling every 1 to 2 years. And in 2017, it was estimated that knowledge was doubling every few months, if you can imagine that. And of course, that is due to worldwide research and development and intervention and the fact that worldwide computers are hooked together through the internet, so people learn from each other faster and faster and faster. And of course, you have artificial intelligence helping this along. So the point is, like Babylon, we get to the point with knowledge doubling this fast where what the father said about Babylon, he says, nothing will be restrained from them. And today we are on the cusp of genetically modifying human beings to prevent disease or to clone human beings, to basically have a recipe and pick the child of your choice. That is on the horizon. We have artificial intelligence that is capable now of changing the world in ways we just can't even comprehend, and most of those, frankly, are pretty scary. So we see here the fulfillment of Daniel 12 and verse 4 is occurring before our eyes. And we see here that conditions are set, they're coming into place for the time of the end. The third thing we can learn, I'd like to point out, as I said, there are many others, is that our Father is giving us a taste of how fast conditions can change to prepare us. COVID-19. World was fat, dumb, and happy before March, and you look from the beginning of March until today, and how fast has the world changed in so many aspects, just about every aspect, how fast the world has changed. You see, our Father is giving us a taste of that. Our personal lives can change. I remember Jack and Marie Elder, they had a nice home, and a few hours later, that home burned to the ground. So you go from having a nice home to homeless in a matter of hours. Things can change very, very quickly. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. We're told, but of the times and the seasons, brethren, talking about now, you have no need that I write unto you. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 2, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night, when not expected. But the Father is giving a taste to us about how fast things change, so as a warning to His children. The fourth thing we can learn is that, typical of mankind, man is going to ignore all the warnings. Man is just going to blithely go on You know, as long as I have my malls and my NFL, I'll be fine. Matthew 24, let's look at verse 37. Like you know where we're going here. Matthew 24 and verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. And Christ is describing how those days were. Verse 38. But as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they didn't know until the flood came and took them away, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, we've all talked about we are facing probably a new normal going forward because of this pandemic and the financial ramifications and the job ramifications and all of that, the societal ramifications. So, you know, going forward, there's going to be somewhat of a new normal. But this tells us whatever that normal will be the normal, and people will think it's the normal, and life's going to go on until it doesn't. Until the Father and the Son return. So that leads us to the third and final section of the Scripture. What should our response be? What should we be doing in light of this coming reality? What should be our priorities? Well, the first thing to alleviate fear is we have to realize that our Father is in control of everything. And once we deeply understand that the Almighty, and that title is there for a reason, the Almighty is in control of everything, then we as His people can take a deep breath and relax a little bit. Let's go to Matthew 10 and verse 29. Christ is speaking to His disciples. Matthew 10, verse 29, I'll read this out of the NLT. The disciples were apparently worried because they had given up jobs, they have left their homes, they've left their families, they're following this guy throughout all these towns, and they probably had a little fear or a little anxiety or a little worry. Matthew 10, verse 29, NLT, not even a sparrow, Christ says, worth only a half a penny, can fall to the ground without your Father's knowing it. My personal speculation is that somehow, some way, through a spirit, the Father, all life is connected together, somehow, some way. And if life stops, the Father knows. Verse 30, and the very hairs on your head are all numbered. Who wrote the DNA? Who designed all that? There's a great program on Nova about DNA and what they're finding, and you just scratch your head and say, these guys are delving into this, and the only conclusion you can draw is somebody designed it. This didn't happen on its own. The very head of the hairs on your head are numbered, and verse 31, here's the answer, so don't be afraid. You're more valuable to Him than many sparrows. And the fact is, nothing happens without the Father's knowledge or His approval, His consent, nothing happens. What He causes or what He allows to happen to us is for our ultimate good. Romans 8 and verse 28 says that all things work together for those who love our Father. We can take great comfort in that. So we have to realize the Father is in control when these calamities come upon us. Secondly, our responsibility, what we should be doing, is to draw nearer to the Father and to His Son, to be more like them, to put our total trust in them. It's time to get our minds off petty squabbles and petty issues. Look at what's looming ahead. And we're going to get our nose down in the weeds and worry about this blade of grass versus that blade of grass. Is that what our Father wants us to be doing now? We have to see the big picture, our Father's picture. We look at the world through soda straws. We only see just a little bit. And these words encourage us to open up our mind, look at what's on the horizon, look at what's happening, and maybe our current problems or the current issues we face don't seem quite as great. Let's go to Deuteronomy 4 and verse 26, and we're going to see, kind of surprised me, I had forgotten about this, Moses is giving us a prophecy for today, in part. He's also talking, obviously, to the Israelites before they entered the promised land. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 26. Moses is right in the middle of a condemnation here. He says, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you shall soon utterly perish from off the land wherein you go over Jordan to possess it. Not a pretty picture. You shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. Verse 27. And Yehovah shall scatter you among the nations, and you shall be left few in number among the heathen, where Yehovah shall lead you. Verse 28. And there you shall serve gods, not the Almighty, and the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But notice verse 29. But if from there you shall seek Yehovah your God, you shall find him. If you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul or your being or your life, that is a promise. If we seek the Father with all our heart, we will find him. Verse 30. When you are in tribulation, notice that, they're going to be in tribulation. We're facing tribulation, the great tribulation. When you are in tribulation, all these things are come upon you. Notice this, even in the latter days. I believe Moses is taking this message to Israel, and he knows in the latter days, the Father must have told him, that a similar thing is going to happen. When you are in tribulation and all these things come upon you, even in the latter days, if you turn to Yehovah your God and shall be obedient to his voice, for Yehovah is a merciful God, he will not forsake you, neither destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers which he swore unto them. These were spoken 3,500 years ago. And they're repeated, we won't turn there, Hebrews 13 and verse 5. We're told that the Son and the Father say to us, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So as time progresses, if we're to survive, we have to draw near our Father, we have to obey the two great commandments, we have to draw near our Son in all humility. And we have to look to him, and we can have peace. The third is that we need to become serious and at the same time be calm in the midst of a trial. You have to be serious-minded, and you have to be calm. Conditions are being set for the mark of the beast. For someone to promise mankind that all is going to be good, there will be peace, there will be safety, and I can guarantee that. And then mighty signs and mighty wonders will accompany that. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. We were there in verse 1 a little while ago in verse 2. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. This is something we need to keep in mind. For 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 3, New King James, for when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them. As travail upon a woman with a child, they shall not escape, just like in the days of Noah. Verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. You're all children of light and children of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Now, what does that mean? Not drink alcohol? Be sober? No, that's not what it means. Helps Word Study Dictionary talks about being sober as the Greek word napho, N-E-P-H-O. And it refers to having clear judgment, to be self-controlled, to have one's faculties about them when the opposite is being irrational. So to be sober is to be under self-control, not to be irrational. To have clear judgment about what to do, what to say, what not to say. In other words, we need a calm, cool head going forward. Verse 7, "For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunk are drunk in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, self-controlled, clear-minded, putting on the breastplate of faith and love and the helmet of hope." So we see here being serious, being sober, growing in faith that our Father will look after us and take care of us, growing in love to our neighbor, our fellow man, our brothers and sisters in the church, and above all, love for the Father and His Son. And then this gives us the helmet of hope that we will desperately need. So the point is that our Father is in control of everything, and we have to draw near to Him and near to His Son, and we need to be calm when calamity approaches, calm and serious. Okay, so let's conclude before we run out of time here. So where are we in the end times? Well, we're well past the beginning of sorrows, but we're not yet into the great tribulation, obviously. But here's the reality. We talked about this before services. God's children are in tribulation every day, in case people haven't noticed. We're in tribulation every day, increasingly so. We have not been promised a rose garden. Acts 14 and verse 21. Let's go there. Acts 14 and verse 21. I'll read this out of the NLT. This tells us that Paul and Barnabas, they preached the gospel, the good news in Derbe, made many disciples. They came to Lystra and Iconium and Antioch and Pisidia. So now we pick up the story in Acts 14, verse 22. So they're in Antioch, where they strengthen the believers, that's us, and encourage them to continue in the faith, long-suffering, reminding them that they must enter into the kingdom of God through many tribulations. Paul was reminding the brethren. Will it get worse in the future? That's what God's Word says. It will get much worse in the future. But there is an antidote for these tribulations found in Romans 12 and verse 12. Let's go there. Romans 12 and verse 12. Romans 12 verse 12 says that we ought to be rejoicing in hope. Hope of the future, hope of our salvation, hope of eternal life. Romans 12, verse 12, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, meaning this too shall pass. There is an end to it. And then continuing instant in prayer. So the antidote for tribulation is hope and patience and prayer. We will need those in abundance. And there is great hope through the forerunner of our salvation, Jesus Christ. Look at John 16 and verse 33. Christ is speaking to His disciples the night He was betrayed. He knew what was going to happen to them because He knew what was going to happen to Himself. And yet His mind was on them, not on His suffering. His mind was on them. We can learn from that. He was facing unspeakable pain, and yet His mind was not on Himself. John 16, verse 33, Christ said, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in Me you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation," trouble coupled with fear. "But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." He overcame the world. He set us an example to follow in His footsteps. If we do likewise, guess what? We will be there with Him. And what example did He set for us? What did He say? What are the two great commandments? Love your Father, my Father, with all your being, with all your might, and love your neighbor as yourself. His mind was on his father. His mind was on two things, on his father and on those he was serving. It wasn't on himself. And we can take a lesson from that. This is not the time to be selfish. We need to have our mind on our father and his son. We need to have our mind on our brothers and sisters and not on ourselves. Because what is the sign of the times? Lovers of their own selves. That's creeping into the church, big time, and we cannot allow that to happen. Let's go to a final scripture in Romans 8 and verse 24. Romans 8 and verse 24. Paul asks a question, starting off in Romans 8 and verse 24, or 34, I mean, Romans 8 verse 34. Who is he that condemns? Paul asks. Then he says, look, folks, it is Christ that died. Yes, rather, that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who makes intercession for us. We have his Father, our Father, and his Son. His Son makes intercession for us at the very right hand of God the Father. They exist. They are here. They know everything. They know us. They want us to be his children eternally. Verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? All right, shall tribulation, which we face ahead, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword, all part of the great tribulation, all part of the life that we face ahead of us? For as it is written, for your, Christ's sake, we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. No, in verse 37, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. Again, his mind was not on himself, but on those he loved. Verse 38, for I am persuaded, Paul says, that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, depth, or any creature, spiritual or physical, shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Jesus Christ, our Lord. The only thing that can separate us from the love of our Father is us. That's the only thing that can separate us, is if we get so off track, so involved in the world, so involved in what's going on, so involved in carnal pursuits, that we turn away from God in these last days. So we indeed are facing unprecedented times of trouble. We're going to be tested as never before. And we must draw close to our Father and have the mind of His very Son. We need to be calm and serious about what we face. But the reality is, the good news is, the Almighty and His Son, who has been through this already, are going to take each one of us by the hand and will lead us to salvation.